Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the main stories making the news in business and politics here in Ireland and all around the world. Coming up on today's show, we'll be looking at the art of saying no in the office. And also, this week, Michael McGrath got the justice portfolio in the European Commission. But how did the rest of Europe fare when the big jobs were being doled out? Well, Euronews reporter Jorge Liberado will be joining me later to discuss. And this.
Good morning from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. Gunfire and explosions have been heard here and in the second city of Kharkiv shortly after the Russian President Vladimir Putin authorized a special military operation in Ukraine's Donbas region and told the Ukrainian military to lay down their weapons and go home.
Yes, it's 2.5 years since the war in Ukraine started, and we're going to take a look today at where it stands now and how the people of Ukraine are faring as they head into yet another winter. I'll be speaking to documentary maker Jack Losh and also Dr. Patrick Burry from the University in Bath. You can email me at takingstock@newstalk.com. I'm also open on Twitter at StockNT. Now, first up today, we're going to look at the art of saying no, because saying no for some people can be more difficult than others, and even more so in a work environment. Well, somebody who's looked at this in great detail over the years is a journalist called Emma Jacobs, and she is with the Financial Times, and she and her colleagues have been looking at this issue of late. Emma, you're very welcome to News Talk's Taking Stock.
Hi.
Now, Emma, like, it can be more difficult for some people than others. I have a friend in a kind of professional capacity, and when I ask him to do something or when I ask him to go someplace, he just says no and he stops blank, and I'm waiting for an excuse and it never comes, and I just wish I was like that. But it can be difficult for some people, can't it? And very easy for others.
Well, I think it's interesting that you said that your friend is male. I think men find it easier. I'm sorry to start with a sort of sweeping statement, but there was a book written a couple of years ago by four women that started a no club where they just held each other accountable because they found that they were just taking on too many little tasks. Mm. And they were quite surprised by the number of male colleagues that were brilliant. They were in academia, that they were brilliant in their field, but couldn't work the photocopying machine or couldn't figure out how to do the dishwasher or any of the other little things that they were kind of ended up doing themselves, or saying yes to small sort of administrative tasks that sounded good in theory, like, I don't know, being part of some sort of convened group, but then they found that it was just taking up a lot of time and it wasn't visible or promotable. And so they held each other to account to say no. I mean, I'm like you, I think I just say, yes, or thanks for asking. I'm so grateful to be asked.
Yeah.
And it's very hard.
It is hard. And you mentioned that the book that, about the four ladies who looked at this issue, there was also four scientists who, approached this with a much more systematic view. And they actually had a kind of an exercise for themselves. Maybe you talk us through what they did and what they found out at the end.
So they four scientists decided to, they wrote a paper on it in the end, that Polita Clark, my colleague, talked about in a recent column, where they would collectively turn down 100 work-related requests and see what happened. And they did it. They turned down grant proposals, journal articles, turned down speaking invitations to try and get to 100, so 25 rejections each. So they kind of, when Polita followed up with them, she found that they'd continued beyond their experiment. They got even better at saying no. So I think that we're kind of gamifying it and making it a target made it a lot easier. They'd reframed the kind of problem, which was they were just saying yes to too many things, or soft no's, I've done it. I'm sure you've done it, where you just say, I can't really do it. But, and then somebody says, well, you know, how about you fit it in with this, or we can move the other thing, when all you wanted to do was just say no. But you end up doing it, and you're doing it on top of the other thing that you were hoping to do and focus on properly.
Yeah. And then reading through that experiment and the piece that Polita wrote about this, very interesting, their observations as the process moved on. You know, very often what a lot of us deal with in trying to say no is these feelings of guilt or feelings of regret or feelings of potential like missing out on things. Mm-hmm. And actually in the experiment, the more they went on and rejected things that they ordinarily might have said yes to, they felt a lot freer. So the irony is it actually makes people feel in the end a lot better, even though you're maybe not working as hard.
Yeah, well, I think that you can concentrate on, I mean, it's quite easy for journalists and maybe academics who can see the kind of output. So recently I was looking through the things that I'd done in the last year, and I thought, if I'd done fewer of the smaller things that I'd obviously said yes to, I could have concentrated on the bigger things that would have been higher profile or kind of more kind of intrinsic value, that I would have kind of put more effort into it and had longer time to think about it. I mean, you know, not everyone's a journalist, but that's a kind of obvious, you know, output. Not everyone's job is so easy to see in terms of output, but you know, it felt very stark that you could say, oh, if I just rearranged my time better, I could have done something more focused and a bigger and better job. So saying no might serve you better in the long term.
Yeah, and then you have the issue of, you know, quality over quantity. So you might be doing an awful lot and feel like a busy, just for this example, a busy journalist, but actually, are you doing your best quality work? And I think actually, while we're on the subject of journalism, it's really important to look at how different professions change, and they can be stretched then, really, because years ago, like, journalists would have just been expected to come in, write a column, that's it. Now you've got to do what you're doing now, come on radio, talk about it, maybe promote your brand online as well. So your professional life can get fuller incrementally by accident.
Yeah, there's a lot more tasks. I mean, I think that I think journalism's expanded. Lots of other jobs are expanding to kind of do work around work. So, you know, it's not always, it can be quite hard to tell what your output is sometimes in especially white collar work, because there's so much work around doing work, as you say, like promoting yourself on social media or you know, coming on radio is a delight, but kind of all these other aspects to work that aren't necessarily just the job, the pure job.
That's a great phrase, work around work, because work in our lives has become sort of omnipresent now. I don't know whether we've COVID to thank for that or it was always going to be the case. But saying no in a work environment is actually quite difficult, even in terms of the hours. I suppose there's some companies who are doing a better job at making people not feel like they have to be present after 6 p.m. in the evening. But is there any tips you can give people about the art of saying no in that work environment, and how might that differ in your personal life?
I could give tips that I don't follow.
Give us tips and we'll all try.
Well, I think actually what these women did, both the ones in Polita's piece and also the women that wrote the book on the No Club, by forming a kind of group of people that are aware they've got a problem, you know, that's the first step. So you can kind of really bolster each other and say, you know, let's just say no. I think having a target is a great idea. Not everyone will do that or can do it, but I think being really conscious of it and talking about saying no, as opposed to just being so pathetically grateful to be asked, is really, you know, hold yourself accountable to saying no and kind of figure out your boundaries. I mean, which is something that I'm terrible at. As you say, the technology kind of expands, the workload expands to fill your day, everything becomes blurry. You know, the flexibility has been a great opportunity, but it's also created kind of blurred boundaries, which you know, you have to kind of put in place some yourself. So just being conscious of it, and you know, ideally having some discussion with your manager.
Yeah, because I think that
those rules might be.
I think that flexibility issue is and can be used by some people to their advantage. In managers now or employers, because I think that idea of saying no to someone if they're asking you to work beyond hours now, it could be challenging depending where you're in the company. If you're just somebody who's just bored, you might not feel confident enough to say, "Well, excuse me, you know, that's outside of the hours that I signed up for."
Well, yeah, and definitely if you're say asking for flexibility yourself, there's a lot of blurring. You know, are you coming in late because you want to drop your kids off at school, or do you want to take a bit of time out because you want to go to an exercise class? You know, this kind of two-way flexibility, it needs negotiation on both sides, really.
Mm-hmm. And that finding that happy medium, I suppose, is the ideal word that we all want to end up in. We mentioned at the beginning there, my friend who has absolutely no problem saying no whatsoever and gives no explanation either. And you said it was interesting that it was a male. And I don't like talking about these stereotypes, but, you know, does it break down like that? Are men find it much easier in a work environment to just say no?
I think that they've to vastly generalize and extrapolate from my own anecdotal observations. I think that they don't tend to get asked to do smaller tasks that aren't related to their jobs. If you ever look at a colleague having a birthday or something in the office, and then just watch to see men walk away from the crumbs of the cake and the plates left over that sometimes they don't sort of tidy up or do the kind of present buying. Or I've kind of decided to opt out of those things more consciously so that you don't end up doing the as these women call them, non-promotable tasks.
And that's interesting, isn't it, though, that maybe it's a subconscious thing. They're not doing it because they don't see it as part of their promotion. It's just not something that would ever strike them to do.
No, and also that they probably don't get asked, and there's less expectation on them. So it's a bit of both, really.
Yeah.
I think that you can make it conscious. You can say, I think that team leaders should try and think about how they're spreading these kind of boring tasks around it.
You've given us some good advice about, you know, grouping yourself into people who feel the same, maybe benchmarking the quality of work you're doing, the amount of time you're spending on it, setting yourself some tasks. But one of the great things that was in that piece was about a firm rejection or a soft no. And you explained earlier, it's a great example, actually, that there's an event coming up maybe in 6 months' time and you don't really think about the consequence of it now. So you kind of say, maybe I might do that. And as it draws nearer, you realise the implications and the work that might be involved with that. So really to think about what you're committing to early on is important, isn't it?
Well, I think another colleague of mine has a rule that only say yes to things that you'd want to do tomorrow. So don't, 6 months is a long time. You can kind of be very vague about it, but try and imagine that it's tomorrow and then think how you'd feel about it.
Yeah, that's a really good tip. I'm going to use that one for sure. Well, Emma, look, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I'm glad that you didn't say no to doing this interview because I found it fascinating. That was Emma Jacobs from the Financial Times. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks very much.
You're listening to News Talks Taking Stock. Coming up, as the people of Ukraine head into another winter, we're going to look at the war in Ukraine 2.5 years on. You're welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, unbelievably, it's 2.5 years since Russian President Vladimir Putin initiated war against Ukraine on the 22nd of February in 2022. Since then, thousands of civilians have been killed or injured and many have been forced to evacuate. Well, I'm joined now by journalist and documentary maker Jack Losh to discuss another winter approaches us, and we're going to talk about the war to date and what might be expected in the coming months ahead. Jack, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's great to be here.
Now, like, I just wanted to try and go back to the beginning. Like, when this war started 2.5 years ago, the initial feeling was that it would be a short, sharp war. That was the sense of it, wasn't it, really?
Well, it was in a way, and there certainly were warnings that the Russian President Putin was hoping to take Kyiv in days. But clearly that's not the case. 2.5 years on, untold tragedy and economic cost, it's still going on. But I also think the kind of 2.5 year date is not the one to be focusing on. Really, I think you have to take it back about 10 years to 2014 to get a real context of how utterly surprising and shocking that this war is still going on. And that takes us back to 2014 during its pro-European revolution, when Ukrainian President Yanukovych was ousted. And that moment is what kind of set the wheels in motion for what we see today. And there's really kind of five parts to that. I mean, that first part was revenge and disruption, Ukraine rejecting Russia, moving towards Europe. And in response, Putin sent in his troops to annex Ukraine's southern peninsula on the Black Sea, Crimea, and stirred up armed conflict in the eastern region of Donbass, a region now which is even more wild, even more mired in this extreme violence and warfare. What followed that was years and years of stalemate, where that Eastern war diminished in intensity with a ceasefire deal, but it did smoldering on, albeit with many thousands of deaths, until early 2022, when this full-scale invasion started. And I think the phrase, you know, full-scale is key, because there had been that earlier covert invasion in 2014. And yeah, like you said, there were warnings that Putin wanted to take Kyiv in days, possibly 3 days. We now know that didn't work out. And that led to the next phase, which lasted for about a year, of resistance, where we saw increasing Western weapon supplies, the mass enrollment of Ukrainians into the armed forces, disastrous Russian tactics that resulted in Ukraine halting that Russian advance. And then ultimately, later on in 2022, dramatic Ukrainian counteroffensives up in the northeast around Kharkiv and down in the south towards Kherson. Since then, up to where we are today, it's been a period of stagnation, surprises, and now potentially exhaustion. Stagnation in that the much-vaunted counteroffensive last summer around the southern Zaporizhia region didn't work out. It was a failure. About a month or so ago, we saw a surprise when Ukraine launched this completely unprecedented offensive into Russia, onto Russian soil, that first invasion since the Second World War, onto Russia. And now this sense of exhaustion that there are mounting Ukrainian losses in that eastern Donbass region, that same region where 10 years ago that first Russian covert invasion happened. You couple that with the looming US election, which, if Donald Trump wins, could leave Ukraine high and dry with dramatically less Western support. It has been a roller coaster ride. And yes, Ukraine surprised everybody by lasting this long. But the threats to that, the risks, the uncertainty has really increased over the last few months.
Yeah, well, look, Jack, that's a fantastic précis of where we've come and the history of what has happened even before 2022. I'm also joined on the line by Dr. Patrick Burry. He's from the Department of Politics, Languages and International Studies at the University of Bath. Dr. Burry, you're very welcome to Taking Stock. I want to bring you in here, please, because what we're trying to do now is evaluate where we're at in 2.5 years of this war, and if we can, at least, to try and quantify some of the losses and gains. And maybe you could start us off, I don't know if this is even possible to do, but look at the loss of life, the exodus of people, you know, from the Ukraine. Is it possible to even quantify at this stage how this war has affected the population in that way?
It's very difficult, I think, to know exactly. The Ukrainian keep the military losses pretty tight, as you can imagine, because it's a source of national and military morale. But the US has done its assessments, of which, when you take into account missing, etc., it looks like they've taken somewhere in the region of about 80,000 losses. I mean, it's a drop in the ocean, really, compared to the Russian losses of 500,000 at least. But it's still very significant, as you can imagine. On the population figures, you know, I wouldn't have that at the top of my tongue. It was a population pre-war 40 million. And as of a few months ago, I think it was in the region of the low millions that had left. But it's growing, of course. It certainly was in the last few years. It might have slowed down a bit now because the people have decided to stay, you know. So great cost. I mean, the other thing that's cost is great cost in the destruction of Ukrainian infrastructure, which is happening at an alarming rate, as your other contributor said. You know, and just in the last while, the Russians are really getting into a groove in terms of targeting their infrastructure, their energy infrastructure, their water infrastructure. It's going to be a very difficult winter, probably the most difficult for the Ukrainians, given the damage that those systems have sustained.
Jack also mentioned that what is looming in that winter, not just the difficult conditions they have, is the US presidential election, which is looming over them. Jack, I might bring you in there as to why this is such an important juncture for the Ukrainian war.
Yeah, so I mean, the reason the US election is such an important moment in this, you know, one of the main reasons is that Western weapons has helped Ukraine stay afloat for so long, and Trump, isolationist and politely put unpredictable as ever, has threatened to take this away. But I think that is, Trump is almost one smaller problem in a much bigger problem with Western arms supply. Is that the Ukrainians haven't been able to rely on them consistently from the beginning. There was great resistance in the early days to start even sending, you know, relatively small anti-tank javelin anti-tank missiles to the Ukrainians. And then the West started to do that. And then there was calls for them to send in tanks. There was great resistance about that, especially in Germany. Eventually, they did that. Now, the kind of the big debate is whether Ukraine can launch long-range Western weapons, missiles into Russia to disrupt Moscow's military campaign in Ukraine. All the way along, it seems that the Western countries have been slightly, understandably wary, but behind the curve of what Ukraine actually needs to stem the Russian advance. And that has been a problem all the way along. The looming specter of Trump makes that an even greater risk for Kyiv.
Yeah. Patrick, I'll bring you back in here. One of the big things that happened from the Western perspective with the start of this war was this onslaught of sanctions against Russia. I think they're the most sanctioned country now in the world. And there was this real sense that if the West pulled together, invoke these sanctions, that the Russian economy would suffer greatly and they would be badly affected and maybe bankrupt. What happened there to their economy on foot of those sanctions?
I think sanctions take a long time against the middle power. That's the first thing. They work against small economies pretty rapidly, against middle and large countries. You know, it's a much longer burn, if at all. That's the first thing. I also, obviously, the Russian economy puts itself on a 75% war footing, so that's big employment. It's pumping, throwing money, so $60,000 a year to go and sign up into the Russian army. That's a huge wage, by the way, in Russia. And the oil price, oil and gas price, as a result, shot up. And that, even though Russia lost some of its supplies to the West, of course, not all, but some. But you've got willing buyers in China and India. So that favoured it. Now the oil price is starting to drop, as most of us and will be interesting to see how much that affects. But yeah, it's proved more resilient, at least in the medium, short to medium term. Over the long run, it does not look great for Russia. But that's a different story, really, because they're in the ascendancy at the moment. And I think, you know, on the Western Asia, you know, these long range strike munitions, I would have been really surprised if they'd come in. And the mood music looked like that last week. with Keir Starmer's visit to the US, but it seems like it's gone back to a no anyway for the moment. And the reason that is because as much as Ukraine needs them, giving one nuclear power, giving its ally the authority to use its own weapons to strike another nuclear power's home air bases on its own territory is really quite an unprecedented move in international security. So I can understand why the Ukrainians want them, although their drone program is working really well. If you saw the massive explosion in a Russian ammunition dump deep into Russia yesterday. So the drones are kind of taking up some of the slack. But yeah, I think the Russian, you know, the American are probably pretty reticent to give the okay for that.
Jack, Patrick mentioned there the geopolitical implications of the nuclear warfare side of things, which are obviously absolutely enormous and existential. But the geopolitical landscape and how it could evolve, depending on the outcome of this war, is also a crucial thing that the world is looking at, right?
It is for sure. And I suppose what we've seen in a nutshell over the last 2.5 years, which has overturned the order of things, is increasingly isolated Russia, with Putin put on the wanted list of the International Criminal Court. Increasing ally of China and Iran, the latter providing these awful attack drones, which Moscow hurls into Ukrainian cities with very little concern for the collateral damage in civilians, and also increasing alliance with international pariah North Korea, which has been providing thousands and thousands of rockets and shells for Russia's war effort. New lows in relations between Western nations and Russia, UK, US and other Western partners potentially considering Ukraine to use these long-range weapons that we discussed. Even India emerging as an interesting player behind the scenes with all of this, with the Prime Minister Modi recently visiting Putin and Moscow, Zelensky in Kiev, promoting himself as a possible peacemaker, which I think is actually probably highly unlikely due to his lack of credibility. But, you know, that has emerged. But, I mean, I think what is interesting as well is not just the way it's overturned that kind of geopolitical order, but what's happening inside Ukraine and what that tells you about what is going to happen next. I mean, what I've seen over the last 2.5 years from my reporting is everything that you would expect from this war and plenty that you wouldn't. You know, I've sat in the back of ambulances speeding out of frontline villages, sitting next to civilians bleeding out of wounds inflicted by Russian artillery, while their loved ones, by the way, lay dead and maimed back at their destroyed homes. I've sat in the basements in ruined frontline towns with profoundly stressed and traumatized civilians while Russian shells and rockets bombarded the surrounding neighborhood, speeding out to frontline positions with Ukrainian platoons. And even in the early first few days of the war, seeing bodies, plenty of bodies of killed Russian soldiers on the outskirts of Kharkiv, when they attempted and failed to enter that city. But also the things that you wouldn't expect. You know, I've been in Kiev, where young, educated, effortlessly cool young Ukrainians would be drinking cocktails and telling jokes in bars in downtown Kiev. I've been out in the remote villages of the Carpathian Southwest, where village life hasn't really changed for centuries, even during the last 2.5 years of full-scale war, spending time with soldiers back from the battle, tending their farmsteads and riding by horse and cart. I think the point that I'm trying to make is that there has been untold chaos and violence and tragedy across the country, and yet that Ukrainian resilience goes on and life very much goes on, even during this awful war. And despite all the kind of obsessing negative things we've talked about, I think that does offer some glimmer of hope for Ukraine going forward into this very uncertain future.
Yeah, and that's a really important part of all of this, like what the life of the citizen is like on the ground and how that has changed over these 2.5 years. But one of the final things I wanted to talk about was territories. So when you're talking about those different experiences that you've had, is that down to timing or geography now? Are there areas of Ukraine which are still as you know, impacted as significantly as you've mentioned now, or is it, and they are confined to particular areas and life is creeping back in the cities and other areas?
So, I mean, I think the front line now is more predictable than it was right at the beginning of the war. I mean, I remember sitting in my hotel in Kharkiv in the first few days, just half expecting a Russian soldier to walk in. And very quickly, that became apparent that that wasn't going to happen. And of course, you know, you can go to Western cities like Lviv or Uzhgorod or even Kyiv, and there is no imminent threat of the Russians reaching there anytime soon, if at all. I think the one place which is a cause for serious concern for Ukraine and for people who care about Ukraine is the eastern Donbass. And right now, the epicenter of that is a town called Pokrovsk, which is a key logistics and transport hub. Ever since the fall of another eastern Ukrainian town, Avdiivka, earlier this year, the Russian forces have been grinding slowly but surely and ruinously towards this town westwards. They're now at the gates of Pokrovsk. I think I saw 7 or 8 kilometers at the last count, and gaining ground, so it seems, every single day. There is a sense, unfortunately, that the fate of that town is going to be the fate of all the other towns in that total destruction and eventually falling to the Russian forces. And what that means is that it does raise the likelihood of Russia capturing the entire Donbass region and even advancing further westwards towards the major industrial city of Dnipro, an even greater possibility. That town is a linchpin. It has practical value, it has symbolic value, and right now its chances of survival are looking increasingly unlikely, unfortunately.
Unfortunately, gentlemen, time is upon us. I did want to ask you about lots of other things, but maybe we'll come back at this another day. I think it is important beyond the daily news cycle that we get just to kind of step back. And I really appreciate both of your time today to do just that for us. My thanks to Jack Losh, who is a journalist and documentary maker, and also to Dr. Patrick Burry at the Department of Politics, Languages and International Studies at the University of Bath. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us on.
This is Newstalk's Taking Stock after the break. As Ireland secures a middle-ranking portfolio at the EU Commission, we look at the rest of Europe, who got what, and what it all means for little old.
In this election, we each face a question. What kind of country do we want to live in? We choose freedom. The freedom not just to get by, but get ahead. The freedom to make decisions about your own body. We believe in the promise of America, and we're ready to fight for it. Because when we fight, we win.
I'ma keep on running because the winner don't quit on themselves.
Paid for by Harris for President.
Ireland. Welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, following much speculation and months of behind the scenes vying for position, this week, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen revealed the shape and the names of the new commission. And delighted now to be joined on the line by Jorge Liborado from Euronews. Jorge, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Hi, Mandy. Hello from Brussels.
Thank you, Jorge. Listen, this announcement wasn't easy at the end of the day. There was a lot of hiccups before she even got to the press conference to make the announcement. Maybe talk us through the stops and starts before we even got there.
Well, you're totally right. It was quite a saga in anticipation of this announcement. First of all, we know that the president demanded all member states to submit two names for European Commissioner, a man and a woman, so she could guarantee a gender balance in the next commission. What happened? That most member states, in fact, all of them except Bulgaria, completely ignored this request. So they kept sending men, men, men. So there was a lot of, you know, behind the scenes negotiations for von der Leyen pushing certain member states like Romania and Slovenia to change their mind and put forward a woman. So this delayed. And then in Bulgaria, this backfired. It caused a national, let's say, fight between parties and the opposition. and the Slovenian appointment ended up being delayed, so her presentation was also delayed, but she managed in the end.
She did. I heard at the press conference, she said that the initial round of submissions that were made to her were mostly men. I think the split was 72% to 28%.
Yes.
And eventually she did get to 40% of women in terms of representation. So that's a good thing. But we'll come back to the gender issue and how it all played out at the end of the day. I think, though, she even rang Emmanuel Macron and said that if they put in a female name, there was an offer of a better position.
Well, I think with Macron, the issue was that she just wanted to get rid of Thierry Breton, the French commissioner, who's quite powerful in charge of the internal market. Breton has undermined von der Leyen several times publicly, and I think she was tired of it. So she asked Emmanuel Macron to replace him. And in fact, she didn't ask for a woman.
Oh.
She just asked for another name that was not Thierry Breton. So that's how much animosity was there between them.
Well, he seemed more than happy to give the name very quickly anyway.
Yes.
But she also introduced some new structures, Jorge. Maybe talk us through what those new structures are in this commission.
Well, the new commission has a very, very prominent focus on competitiveness, which means basically the economy. So if we take a look around the organigram, you see that most titles have something to do with the economy. You know, you see clean transition, you see prosperity, industrial strategy, you see people skills preparedness, you see tech sovereignty, which is interesting. So we see that the commission has been, let's say, redesigned according to this big goal of competitiveness, which has become very worrisome for every European leader, you know, regardless of political ideas, you know, that Europe is lagging behind the US and China, and this decline might at one point become irreversible.
Mm.
So that's what she reflects in this big push, you know, for the economy.
You mentioned competitiveness there. The big thing that she also mentioned repeatedly was this issue of security as well.
Yes.
And the Balkan states did remarkably well in a lot of the portfolios. Could that security issue have something to do with it?
I think so, because, you know, Eastern Europeans, especially the Balkans, have been vindicated, you know, after Russia invaded Ukraine. You know, you told us this would happen. We ignore you. Von der Leyen has said this several times. We should have listened to you earlier. So I think, as you rightly pointed out, that these assignments for the Baltics reflect this change of mindset that the European Union has undergone in the past 2 years. You know, we have become more Easterner in our thinking of of security and geopolitics. So we see, you know, the Lithuanian commissioner got defense and space, and we also see Kaja Kallas from Estonia becoming the foreign affairs and security policy chief, you know, the high representative.
A lot of maneuvering behind the scenes this time before the appointment of the College of Commissioners was appointed. For you, Jorge, when you were looking at it on the day, what were the surprises that you said that might cause some issues before we get to appointment?
I was quite surprised with some things, I have to say, to the point that I was a bit jaw-dropping for me. First of all, migration has gone to Austria, which is a country that, you know, has a hard line on migration, has been condemned by the European Court of Justice, has opposed the integration of Bulgaria and Romania into Schengen. So I was really surprised, everybody was, to see Austria getting migration. Then I was also surprised by the fact that Mato Šefčovič got the trade portfolio, which is very important because it was not rumored at all for him to get this trade portfolio. And then another surprise was that Italy did get an executive vice presidency, but it was kind of a powerless executive vice presidency because it's cohesion and reforms, so nothing extremely sensitive or high profile. So I think von der Leyen gave Giorgia Meloni a halfway gift, you know, to keep her happy but not too powerful in Brussels.
And that appointment, the next part of the process, the Italian commissioner, could that be an issue when it gets to the approval stage? Or do you think that this is all a done deal?
I think the hearings in the European Parliament are going to be very tough for everybody overall. But I think, yes, Raffaele Fitto, the Italian nominee, is going to get a hard time because there's a lot of animosity in the European Parliament towards Giorgia Meloni, you know, liberals, socialists, Greens see Meloni as a dangerous force in Europe that is normalizing the far right. So I think they're going to use Fitto as a stand-in for Meloni. So it's going to be the hearing of Meloni, but without Meloni.
Okay, I see. So then the other surprise is Jorge, who were the big losers in the appointments this week?
Well, the biggest loser is, of course, Hungary. We know that von der Leyen and Viktor Orban had the relation is an all-time low at the present moment. So what she did was she gave the Hungarian nominee, Oliver Varhelyi, the portfolio for health and animal welfare. We have to keep in mind that until now, Varhelyi was in charge of enlargement, which is a very important, very political portfolio. But Varhelyi's mandate has been very controversial. So this reads like a punishment, a total downgrade, in my opinion.
Mm. And some new portfolios completely, housing, there's a commission for housing now, perhaps reflecting how acute this issue is right across the EU.
Yes, of course, housing in every European country, of course, the lack of affordable housing. This was a big demand from the socialists and liberals to support von der Leyen's re-election. So she gave that to them. And we see that housing has been paired with energy for Dan Jorgensen, who is the Danish commissioner. It's an interesting pair, you know, energy and housing is not completely related. So it shows that housing is going to be more of a second thought in this portfolio, as the commission does not have direct power to regulate housing. This is a national competence. So this commissioner will be more in charge of strategies, recommendations, studies, research and things like that, but not hardcore regulation.
And what about the Green Deal and the environment? Was there much emphasis on that? Who got that?
I mean, the Green Deal is, the name is nowhere to be found in the names. Now we're talking about the clean transition. That's the new Green Deal. So, I mean, we know that there was backlash from conservatives against the Green Deal. So that shows in the names of the portfolios as well that Green Deal is nowhere to be found. But if you read the mission letters to the commissioners, every mission letter mentions that it's important that the EU meets the targets and goals of the Green Deal that have been agreed during this legislation. So the Green Deal is there, it's legislation, they need to make it happen, they need to cut emissions by 55% at least by the end of this decade, and it's something, you know, horizontal across all portfolios. But the main person in charge will be Teresa Rivera from Spain. She will be in charge of the clean transition, next to Wopke Hoekstra, the Dutch commissioner, who will also be in charge of climate, especially climate diplomacy.
Now, our own Michael McGrath was appointed to justice. How do you see that portfolio, and what will he be in charge of in the commission?
Look, I know that for many Irish people, the appointment was a surprise because this man has a very strong financial background and he was given something that is basically not financial, which is democracy, justice and the rule of law. But I have to say that as a journalist here in Brussels, I find this portfolio extremely important. Why? Because we see all around Europe that there's a trend, a very worrisome trend of democratic backsliding, and that we need to have rule of law at the very top of the agenda. We have issues with Hungary, Slovakia, until very recently with Poland, a very serious issue about judiciary. And it keeps getting worse. You know, Bulgaria, just recently, they passed an anti-LGBT legislation. So this means that people are looking at the commission for answers on the rule of law. People don't want the commission to pay EU funds to countries that are blatantly violating these fundamental rights. So Michael McGrath will be on the front line of this fight. He will be the face of this, basically.
Yeah, Jorge, would he be in charge then? He's the person then who has to go and do the negotiations with member states who are, you know, contravening EU laws as well. I'm thinking of Viktor Orban here and the 200 million fine. That's his portfolio. Is that right?
Yes, I mean, he will be in charge of that. The 200 million fine is also related to migration, so he will also have to work with the migration commissioner. But yeah, I mean, in every issue related to rule of law and the breaches of EU law, he will be in charge of that. And yeah, he will have to put up a fight with these countries and lead the legal action that the commission takes in the European Court of Justice, you know, to bring these member states back into legality.
Yeah, well, it's certainly going to be an interesting time. Jorge, just step back a little bit from the different appointments and in a general sense, the look and feel of this, you know, is a slightly right of centre feel to it, maybe because of what Europe is doing or where Europe is going at the moment. But when you step back from it, what does it say about where Ursula von der Leyen is going now? Is it good for Project Europe or good for Project Ursula?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I mean, it's the key question, actually. When you look at the commission and the new commission and you see the names of these portfolios, you know, they sound very beautiful and appealing. You kind of realize that everything seems to be designed to allow the president to shine even brighter than she did in the previous mandate. What do I mean by this is that the main decisions that were going to be taken, you know, on economy, rule of law, migration, they're going to be led by her personally. Okay, let's not make any mistake with this. She will be very presidential, probably much more, and she wants to avoid any strong personality from emerging, you know, within this commission that could, let's say, somehow overshadow her leadership, like it happened with Thierry Breton, who was one of the main, the strongest personalities in this commission, and he had to dramatically resign at the end, you know, and he actually questioned the president's, and I quote, questionable governance in his resignation letter. But I think she has, you know, she's making sure that this will not happen again and that she will be indeed the president with a tight grip on power.
Mm. She's certainly a formidable lady. We did a big profile of her here and she's gotten through her election now and quite a large amount of her party, I also see, have secured positions in the commission.
Yeah, her own party, for sure, the EPP. I mean, it's a conservative. I mean, we know it's the main conservative party in Europe. It dominates in many member states, and this is reflected in the new commission. But I have to say that for me, the only ideology that matters here is the one that sits at the very top, and this is the president, Ursula von der Leyen. She's a member of the EPP. So, I mean, regardless of how many more EPP people she has in her team, she's the one that matters after all. And I have to say, as you said, that she's indeed a formidable leader. And decentralization of power has also been credited with, you know, putting forward more ambitious proposals when it comes, you know, for instance, the war in Ukraine. So many people acknowledge that she has centralized power, but at the same time that recognize the results of decentralization.
Jorge, thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. It was a fascinating run through of the new commission. That was Jorge Liberado from Euronews. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mandy. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first from Friday mornings on the News Talk app. My thanks, as always, to all of today's guests. And thank you to the producer of Taking Stock, John Fardy, with Simon Keane on research and Hugo De Silva Scott on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, do email us at takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots more, I'm sure. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thanks for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
In this election, we each face a question. What kind of country do we want to live in? We choose freedom. The freedom not just to get by, but get ahead. The freedom to make decisions about your own body. We believe in the promise of America, and we're ready to fight for it. Because when we fight, we win.
I'ma keep on running, 'cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
Paid for by Harris for President.